You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast titled Next Steps After Progression in Gastroesophageal Junction Cancers, Rechallenging with VEGF-Directed Therapy. I'm Dr. Richard Dunn, and I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Pashtoon Kasi from the Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian Hospital Oncology Department. In this podcast, we will discuss the selection of appropriate second and subsequent line therapy for the management of advanced gastric and gastroesophageal junction cancers and how to apply clinical practice guidelines to maximize patient outcomes with these treatments. Welcome, Dr. Kasi, and thank you for joining us today. Hoping you can tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice in New York City.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. So I'm a GI oncologist. I'm at Cornell, as you mentioned. I focus on treating patients with gastrointestinal cancers, including gastric and esophageal and other GI cancers, including colorectal cancers. And then from a research standpoint, I've been focusing on liquid biopsies and circulating tumor DNA tests and using those in terms of bringing more options and trials for our patients along the lines of precision medicine. So kind of two hats that I wear that help complement each other.
Well, that's great. And I think I'd like to pick your brain on some liquid biopsy questions during the session today as well. We'll start by discussing the evolving treatment landscape in gastroesophageal cancer. It has rapidly changed in the past few years, particularly in regards to the integration of immunotherapy in the first line treatment, as well as new and emerging biomarkers for first line treatment of gastroesophageal junction cancer. In your opinion, how has this changing landscape in first line therapy impact how we treat patients in the second or third line, or does it not impact it at all?
It's a question that has many aspects to it. So overall, you know, I would say advances are coming more so in like subsets. So there are some precision medicine-based therapies that you need a specific marker for. So not all therapies are helping all patients with all cancers. And that's also true for stomach and esophageal cancers to an extent. You know, on the notion of how the first-line therapies have evolved, I think the biggest thing, as you mentioned, is the introduction of addition of immunotherapy to the chemotherapy backbone that, you know, for the first time in years, you know, we're noticing median survivals that are, you know, not just months, but are crossing a year or so. So that downstream has consequences in terms of how the cancer is treated, in terms of from an immune microenvironment standpoint, in terms of cumulative toxicity and options. So both from a patient as well as a cancer standpoint, how the patient is treated first line affects, you know, the outcome in the long run, both not just from a quality of life standpoint, but also from a survival standpoint.
I remember a few years ago, you and I discussing how immunotherapy or patients treated with immunotherapy subsequently the use of anti-angiogenic drugs may be actually more efficacious. And there actually have been retrospective studies that have looked at this, one that was recently published in Asia, showing that patients that got IO before a drug like ramucirumab actually had better response rates than if it were flipped the other way around. So with the integration of immunotherapy to the first line, do you think this might improve efficacy in treatment in the second line?
We actually had a immunotherapy trial in the second line setting. So, of course, you know, in my opinion, and I think it's endorsed by NCCN on every single page that they have, is, you know, the management, the best management of a patient, you know, lies in a clinical trial. So if I have a clinical trial that's offering, let's say, an immunotherapy-based combination, I would choose that over, you know, standard of care options. So once we had that as an option, we had the opportunity of having patients who had immunotherapy before they got exposed to anti-VEGF or ramucirumab. And, you know, we came across these observations where, you know, in patients where not only did immunotherapy not work, there was also concerns that maybe things got worse, or even the question of the entity of hyperprogression. But then, you know, we moved on to what we would have done for those patients, give them ramucirumab, you know, with or without Taxol. And we stumbled upon, you know, way better than expected responses and durable and clinical improvement that was just unheard of. And, you know, that observation, as you mentioned, you know, has expanded to more than just a few anecdotal cases. We were able to compile a series of patients, both who had ramucirumab before exposure to immunotherapy and also otherwise. And, you know, it's almost two to three times more response as, and more importantly, survival advantage too. And because of that, there's an ongoing study right now. It's called the SEQUEL. They're literally formally studying this observation, as you pointed out, patients getting immunotherapy and then ramucirumab later versus ramucirumab first and immunotherapy later. Of course, the approvals of the first line immunotherapy had made accrual a little challenging for a period of time, but that is a formal clinical trial that, in addition to just retrospective observations, which are profound, and like I said, having tangibly experienced it myself in terms of patients who had outcomes far superior to the trials that are reported, that trial formally will help identify the question. And it seems like, as you were mentioning, it has to do with its effect on the immune microenvironment. You know, in the patients that we were able to have pre and post biopsies on, we saw a rapid decline in T regulatory cells. As we know, there are good immune cells, bad immune cells. So whatever anti-VEGF or the Taxol in addition to it does, it probably flips the immune microenvironment that's more conducive to checkpoint blockade, which is already in your system as you're getting exposed to an anti-VEGF and a chemotherapy that is more than just chemotherapy.
So moving on to specific treatment strategies in the second line, let's say you're seeing a second opinion, right? A patient who had HER2-positive gastric cancer, received FOLFOX, trastuzumab, and pembrolizumab in the first line, and then had progression. And you're seeing this patient to discuss second line therapy. Can you just go through your general approach with this patient in terms of sequencing of treatment, how you might make a decision of utilizing Taxol and ramucirumab versus potentially trastuzumab deruxtecan, which is also approved in the second line, and also if you could, you know, provide some insight on what sort of biomarker testing you might do in this patient.
It doesn't get any more complicated when you have actually a HER2 positive patient too, since it opens up the HER2 based HER2 directed therapies as options as well. For me, you know, it somewhat boils down to initially the patient part of things. You know, as you mentioned, if this patient, for example, was exposed to a platinum-based therapy, in terms of how much cumulative neuropathy they have, makes me decide which chemotherapy backbone I might choose. You know, often I tend to do this a lot. I know with other trials and colleagues, you're putting the oxaliplatin aside after 4 to 6 cycles. Each case is individualized, but if you don't have cumulative neuropathy, then it opens up the option of Taxol-based therapies. But the other thing I wanted to point out is that out of a phase 2, which is also now guideline endorsed, you don't necessarily need Taxol as your partner for ramucirumab. You also have the option of FOLFIRI, which is kind of like a neuropathy sparing regimen alongside ramucirumab, that's also available as an option. So often, you know, second line, I might choose a nerve neuropathy sparing regimen with FOLFIRI with ramucirumab. Now, to the point of HER2-based therapy, even though trastuzumab deruxtecan is approved second line or beyond, the trial was more so patients who were third line and beyond.
DESTINY-Gastric01 is what you're referring to, correct?
Exactly. And then the question of, you know, one of the mechanisms of resistance, and that goes back to your biomarker question, patients can lose, or their tumors can lose the HER2 expression. So while it's not part of the approval to redo biopsy, if safe, feasible, and practical, you know, I would often repeat a biopsy, especially in a patient who's HER2 positive, not necessarily in a HER2 negative, because when you're just exposed to chemotherapy and immunotherapy, there are not many actionable mechanisms of resistance that would make an impact on what you might choose second line or beyond. But for the HER2 part, there's a lot of interesting things that might happen from a resistance standpoint that may affect what you would want to do in second line or even beyond. And also timing-wise, if I could choose a non-HER2-based regimen second line, I could always go back to the HER2-based regimen third line. It's not like it's going anywhere. You know, if you, for example, didn't use trastuzumab deruxtecan second line, you could always use it third line. Furthermore, again, going back to the toxicity standpoint, the antibody drug conjugate does have, again, the percentages are variable from 5 to 15%, but it does have interstitial lung disease and pneumonitis as a potentially, you know, life-threatening side effect. Serendipitously, just a few minutes ago, I'm seeing a patient who's having a great response, but at the same time, therapy has been held because of concerns of, you know, pneumonitis and changes seen on imaging studies. So that also factors in terms of, you know, what to choose in patient second line.
What percentage of your HER2 positive patients are you repeating a tissue biopsy, and what percentage are you repeating a liquid biopsy?
In a perfect world, I would do both. But, you know, to the liquid biopsy question first, I think what's key is, especially when you have somebody who's undergoing treatment, and we also showed this in our Mountaineer for the colorectal study too, if you don't detect ERBB2 or HER2 amplification of the gene on liquid, it does not mean that the tumor is HER2 negative, especially in a patient who was responding and now is having progression. It's very important to distinguish what Dr. Kopitz often calls it as an informative negative versus an uninformed negative report. If you see adequate shedding where the relevant mutation or aberration, I would assume somebody who's getting a second-line therapy would have had some sort of panel-based NGS assay. If you're able to detect, let's say, the P53 or the PIK3CA or the random clones that are present on the liquid biopsy, and then you don't detect ERBB2 amplification to any degree, you wonder if your HER2 expression is preserved or not. However, if you just have a bland report in decimal points that, you know, you're not even detecting relevant clonal aberrations that you know that this person should have, then, you know, that's not an informative negative report. Then, you know, you should consider doing tissue biopsy to confirm what's going on. Again, in patients with esophageal and gastric cancers, it depends on the safety and feasibility. Their primary, sometimes bleeding could be an issue. So, you know, exposing the risk of biopsy has to be balanced with, you know, how it will change your management. If I were to choose a HER2-based therapy, I would be more inclined to confirm what's going on. If I'm going for a non-HER2-based regimen, since it would not impact my regimen, I may pursue a tissue biopsy in parallel, but I may not wait for the results of that since it will not impact my second-line therapy. Timing-wise, in terms of waiting for the results, if I am going to choose a HER2-based therapy, I would probably get a tissue biopsy first and reserve the anti-HER2-based therapy for third line or beyond.
So in HER2-negative patients, you know, the best evidence in second line probably is from RAINBOW study using paclitaxel and ramucirumab. Are there patients where you're considering in the second line just using ramucirumab alone? And if so, what may that clinical picture look like?
Before, you know, FOLFIRI with ramucirumab was an option in the NCCN guidelines, the cumulative neuropathy from prior platinum-based therapy was something that would sway me away from adding chemotherapy. Sometimes it's also a dynamic decision too. When you have patients who are getting chemotherapy as a backbone and anti-VEGF, it is not uncommon to have instances for the same patient where on a given cycle day, you know, if it's just an infection or white cell counts that are prohibiting you to, for example, give chemotherapy today, I may elect to continue the anti-VEGF part of things and hold chemo and kind of keep it practical as opposed to delaying the whole regimen. Sometimes we have patients who, for example, may have, poorly controlled hypertension or bleeding concerns that, or proteinuria or other considerations that are more VEGF mediated, but may or may not have anything to do with the chemo part of things. So I would say more often than not, I would favor a combinatorial approach with chemo. But even for the same patient, sometimes they may or may not get both the drugs, depending on how they're doing clinically.
Kind of going off here, I mean, you alluded to it just a moment ago, talking about times where you might hold the anti-angiogenic drugs. I was wondering if you could kind of go into a little bit more depth into that topic in terms of situations. One, like, how are you monitoring patients on anti-angiogenic therapies who come in for toxicity checks, or either you or your team, you know, or advanced practice provider or nurse? So what are you monitoring? What are you looking out for? And, you know, situations where you feel very strongly that that treatment needs to be held or modified.
Of course, you know, since the mechanism of action is anti-VEGF-based therapy, so some of the side effects or on-target side effects have to do with, the effects in terms of the endothelium, in terms of blood pressure monitoring. So that's, of course, part of the vital signs that are done for each patient before they get any kind of anti-angiogenic-based therapies. Like the situation I was referring to in terms of, let's say, somebody with a poorly controlled hypertension, you know, that may warrant therapy modification or adjustments. Often, you know, as we've seen in many different tumor types, having some rise in blood pressure actually is somewhat of a predictive marker response in some ways. So it doesn't necessarily mean that therapy cannot be continued, but I would make sure that it's somebody who's reliable, who can check his blood pressure at home. You know, the blood pressure coming into the doctor's office may or may not be the best measure of what's going on with the person at home. So some sort of home monitoring kit, I advise it to patients the moment I start anything anti-VEGF for them. And then, you know, the effects in terms of proteinuria and stuff, urine analysis every other visit or so is something that we try to reflexively piggyback on to make sure that we're monitoring in the rare instance if there is proteinuria that may warrant a 24-hour collection, depending on the amount. That might be therapies or situations. Clinically, of course, sometimes that is concomitant with edema that can be profound. So it's hard to miss those situations. But in terms of labs, clinical exam, and of course, if there are other, you know, issues, a lot of our patients have comorbidities.
I was going to ask you about that. What is your thoughts on these? And this, you know, bevacizumab and other tumor types, we think about this, but certain situations like clots, stroke or TIA, or cardiac complications, are there certain things where you're like feeling like I absolutely need to hold this, or situations where I feel like I need to hold for a period of time, allow these things to recover and then resume?
Well, I don't know if there is like hard evidence to support, what I do. I'm worried more about arterial events. So if somebody had, let's say, a stroke or a TIA or a cardiac event, I think in those kind of scenarios, arbitrarily, 3 to 6 months or longer, I would want to, you know, and also depends on what kind of event it was before going back. And then it's more of a multidisciplinary safety check with our cardiology or neurology colleagues and making sure they're on board before I introduce any of that agents. When it comes to, you know, DVT-PEs and venous events, I don't know if, you know, I've heard different people say different things, but I don't know if that's an absolute contraindication in my mind, because, things like Corona score, you know, that predict the risk of DVT-PE, and having any kind of GI malignancy in itself puts you at risk, where, you know, ASCO has guideline statements for even prophylactic anticoagulation in the setting of even without having any blood clots. So if somebody has a DVT-PE and they are on anticoagulation, I don't think that's an absolute contraindication to using anti-VEGF. Of course, you may want some interval of time, and also depends, you know, if it was a incidentally caught DVT on routine or a PE on routine imaging versus something that was clinically significant, that may alter my decision as to when to introduce anti-VEGF. But for the latter, I don't see that as an absolute contraindication, because it's not a single day, as you know, in your own clinic too, that you don't get a call regarding somebody starting some sort of anticoagulation, either because it's symptomatic or it was just picked up on routine imaging.
Are there certain places that you'll look to? I mean, I know you got a ton of experience, and sometimes looking at, you know, you're not looking at guidelines for every patient, but are there certain things that you look at, NCCN, package inserts of the drugs, certain things that you reference, you know, to help guide you in some of these tough situations?
In some cases, it could be yes. There are many platforms now where colleagues like you and other experts are engaging in clinical discussions. I find those helpful, because I don't think you'll find a clinical trial for every clinical question that you will have in clinic. So sometimes, you know, it is case-based learning. There are cases or situations that we're discussing right now on this podcast are things that are being discussed at some of these conferences as well, in these satellite sessions and symposia. So it's an ongoing learning. But, you know, to your point, I do reference the guidelines often, because, you know, like even when FOLFIRI with ramucirumab was included in the guidelines, I didn't even know. I serendipitously, you know, stumbled upon it. And I was like, you know, wait a minute, when did this get into the guidelines? So I think it helps me keep up to date regarding options that are, you know, not everything that's FDA approved. Not everything is FDA approved. Some things are only guideline endorsed. But as long as it's guideline endorsed or FDA approved, it means that that is something that I can get it as an approved option for my patients. In that scenario, you know, going back to guidelines, and also, you know, we are an academic teaching place, and also we work with advanced practice providers. Often, you know, for each individual patient, depending on how busy the clinic is, just whenever we're making a change in treatment, I find it helpful to kind of visualize it with the team as to why we're choosing a particular option and what are the other options for each patient, so that they are aware. I would even sometimes, you know, use that as a template for patients to show them that these are the options and I'm choosing this, unless, of course, I have a clinical trial, which would be then my preferred choice.
It's a great point. That's one of the things we cover in the lecture series, is FOLFIRI ramucirumab is an option, which I think is overlooked by many. For the last couple of minutes here, I want to kind of look towards the future. We've talked about ramucirumab. So what anti-angiogenic agents are there available or under investigation that would be appropriate to consider? And along that same line, could you share with the audience, in your perspective, which are the most anticipated trials in the refractory setting for advanced gastric cancer?
So, you know, along the anti-VEGF story, you know, there some of the anti-VEGF part is being developed along the lines of, you know, could these be, you know, pills instead of intravenous administration. I think there is practical value to drugs that are, you know, coming of age in that strategy. The other trials that are in already open, and some of them we have them here too at Cornell and some other places, are, you know, combinatorial strategies of combining some sort of TKIs that also hit anti-VEGF alongside other immunomodulatory properties, something like, for example, lenvatinib, and the so-called LEAP studies that are ongoing in different types of malignancies where it's being added to the chemo backbone. For the overall, I would say I'm very excited about, you know, trials that are looking at subsets that we didn't think existed before.
It's great. And it's a very exciting time to treat gastroesophageal cancer with the emergence of many great options. And we hope for more to come. So that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Dr. Cassie for sharing his insights and experience with us regarding the use of anti-angiogenic therapies for the second and subsequent line treatment of gastroesophageal junction and gastric cancers. And thank you for joining us. We hope you'll listen to another episode of this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And I want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Eli Lilly, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity. Take care, everybody.